Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming BBC production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to episode 8 of the All Souls Podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer. This week on the All Souls Podcast, we will be discussing chapter 7 of A Discovery of Witches.
So at the end of chapter 6, Diana is rowing in the evening and compares Matthew's following her along the towpath as a dark star guiding her home. Chapter 7 opens with her jolting awake at a quarter past 2 a.m. with the sensation of drowning. Now, have you ever had any dreams of drowning?
No. Anytime I'm swimming in a dream, I can always magically breathe underwater.
That's kind of, it's funny you say that because one of the only recurring dreams that I remember from childhood through young adult, probably early in my 20s at least, I don't know if it's of me drowning because that would mean you die, right? That's the whole point. So I'm not sure I would classify it as a drowning dream, although, I mean, I guess you could, there's the process of drowning, not just someone being dead. But one of the only recurring dreams that I remember is me in the process of drowning-ish. But it was funny because every time I got to the point, like I'd be sinking slowly lower and lower, and I would be holding my breath, trying to fight that, you know, the ultimate thing is like, because once you're at a certain point, when you have no more breath, even though you know you're going to be inhaling water, your instinct overrides everything and you're going to like gulp, hoping for air, knowing it's water, but your body doesn't know. And that's, of course, what begins the drowning. But the funny thing is, when I finally get to that point and I inhale and I struggle against the water, but then every single time I have the dream, if I just relax and let it in, I'm also breathing underwater.
Just let it happen. Just let it happen, Ginger. So how many of those drowning dreams did you wake up with me standing over you with a pillow?
Only those three times.
Only those three times.
Yeah. Unless there's something you didn't
know. This is the only ones you caught me.
Good Lord, if I ever found out anything like that. Oh, my dears.
Please, this is coming from the girl who used to wake me up in my crib just to make me cry.
That's what mom and dad say.
I believe mom and dad.
I have no memory of this.
Of course you don't. You never remember the bad things.
And thus, I cannot be held accountable. But I haven't had that dream in quite a while. I may have had it in my early mid-20s, I think, the last time I remember, but not since then.
No, I only like jolt awake to those like dreams where you feel like you're like suddenly falling, like you jerk awake. That feeling of almost like a roller coaster where you're going down a really fast incline and it's really steep and your stomach just goes up
like
into
that.
Your mouth.
What is it called at Disneyland? The Haunted Hotel?
Tower of Terror.
Thank you. It's a hotel though, right? But it's called
the Hollywood Hotel.
That's what it is. Okay.
But it's the Tower of Terror.
I love that, right? It doesn't scare me. It feels, you know, crappy. I mean, it's a wonderful feeling, but it's freaky, but it's awesome. Diana wakes sweating and she has a raised heart rate. She sees a white face staring back at her in the window. And though she realizes it's her own, it's too late. Her body reacts to seeing that face, and she runs to the bathroom to be sick. Whatever equilibrium she had as a happy, lone historian is gone. And she blames Matthew for her state and the other creatures gathering in the area.
I mean, that's kind of an unfair thing to blame on someone. I'm not saying it doesn't play a part in it, but I mean, she's physically ill. So, I mean, is she saying that Matthew makes her physically ill?
Kelly G. writes, this chapter starts with a slight horror paranormal vibe to it. Diana awakens in the middle of the night in the grips of a terrible nightmare. She dreams she is being drowned, pulled down in the watery depths by an unknown figure. It seems that these nightmares are not unusual for Diana. She often awakes from them before knowing who is trying to kill her. This time, she catches a glimpse of a pale face with dark eyes upon awakening, and this startles her, and she becomes sick, actually vomiting. She realizes after the fact that she had only caught a glimpse of her own reflection in the window, but it's too late. Her body reacts in fear, and she spends time on the bathroom floor, still blaming Matthew and the other creatures for her panic. This is curious, since it seems she's often plagued by terrible nightmares, which would predate her current situation. Once again, Diana chooses to blame others for the situation she finds herself in. Truly, her level of denial is impressive.
But if she was frightened by seeing basically what was her own reflection in the window, do we think that maybe it's kind of foreshadowing that she is, it's something she's doing to herself?
Or that she's somehow changing. Yeah. Changing. Consciously or unconsciously. Well, or, she is changing,
you know,
obviously.
She's being pulled down and she wakes up and she sees something, a face that scares her. You know, she's, you know, maybe that's the quote
maybe
unquote
her
killer.
Her subconscious is
and
doing it.
Yeah. And maybe it's her.
The next morning, she goes out to row, and even the porter asks her to rethink her plans given the fog and the way she looks. She looks tired, unwell, and unsure. The weather, you could say, is also potentially unwell or unsure. In the fog, you can't see, you don't know what's coming to you. Even the healthiest person can get lost or lose their path. Kelly G. writes, the horror theme continues as Diana decides to go rowing despite the porter telling her not to go. It almost gives that horror movie feeling where the woman decides to go off on her own into the forest or other suitable dark place where she will meet a terrible monster. Diana takes to the river in a ghostly veil of fog. Fog is a curious thing that is quite unnerving and disorienting. You can be driving in fog in your own hometown and become very lost. Don't ask how I know this.
Once again, it just highlights how, for an intelligent woman, she makes a lot of weird and not so smart decisions, like rowing in the fog or walking with her eyes closed for like the length of the entire town. Just things that you, like, again, that makes me think of City of Angels, where, you know, the minute Meg Ryan closes her eyes and puts her arms out and stops, you know, pushing her bike, she gets hit by a truck. So just bad decision making.
And I have to say something about driving in fog. First of all, I don't like it.
Who does? Do people like it? Is that a thing?
I don't think so. But I'm prefacing it. Obviously, there's that. What I'm saying is I don't like it. So this may influence what I'm about to say or what I'm about to describe. I have in my life been carsick. When I was young, maybe I got carsick once in a while sitting in the back, or definitely reading. It would make me sick. As a matter of fact, I am still not so convinced that my reading in the car after All Souls Con didn't make me a little bit nauseous, although I think I was coming down with something a few days later.
What was it, carsickness that lasted for 2 weeks?
No. That's weird that you said that. That's true. It was like a cold, but I had nausea for like a week and a half on and off. And no, I was not gestating.
Oh. That was... That was not where I thought you were going to go with that.
What do you think I was going to say?
Well, I thought you were going to say you didn't like actually throw up. You were just nauseous, but you were not gestating.
Was that left field?
For me?
For you.
Clearly not for you. That was totally your train of thought there.
Well, I kept thinking, I would go to work every day. I didn't miss any work. And I was telling people, you know, I just don't feel that. Oh, what's the matter? I'm nauseous. And it was every morning.
I mean, did it go away in the afternoon?
It kind of. But then some mornings it wasn't there, but it was about over a week and a half every day or every other day. I mean, it was this crazy thing, but it would come in the afternoon too, randomly, but it was just weird.
Did you wake up from drowning dreams?
No, not during that time period.
And see a white face in a window?
No. So I never actually got sick. I just felt sick. But I say all this to say, I have gotten sick or nauseous in the car from reading, and I've also had car sickness, and you know, I've been ill or feel nauseous in the car. A few years ago, I was driving from the Central California coast, whatever, Monterey Bay Area, up to something, to a family function, and it was a kind of inclement weather. It was rainy and of course cloudy and foggy, and I don't mind driving in the rain. I slow down, I'm very careful, I do my best, but it was so... This is the only way I can make sense of it for myself. So I'm driving in the fog, driving in the rain. So you're already trying to slow down and be careful. And it's gray. The ground is black, right? The tar is black, but the outside, you can't see anything around you. So everything is gray around you and the fog and the sky. So even if there were you could peek through the fog a little bit, it was a gray sky. So everything was gray around you. Everything. You couldn't see the car. It was a mess. I lost orientation. No, I didn't flip my car, but and I knew I was sitting upright, and I knew the law of gravity was going to keep me, you know, to the earth. But I started, it did something to my equilibrium, and I got nauseous. It's like I felt I had to almost pull over to make sure I was up. It was the weirdest thing ever. And it's happened two or three times since then. I was fine. I just had to like turn on the air conditioning, blow cold air on my face, and just kind of get through it, because there's no way to get out of it except to keep going.
Oh my God. Can we stop talking about being nauseous? That's making me nauseous.
My whole point is the fog is disorienting and it's scary. I literally couldn't tell up from down. So that is kind of an interesting observation looking at Diana, who doesn't get disoriented in the fog. So she jogs to the river. She scales the gate that blocked off the meadows near the river. So she's finding her way. So basically, she has no problem in the fog. The fog may be representative or symbolic, but
it was
she,
also actual. Like it was real.
No,
fog.
I mean, yes, there's real fog, but it also may be symbolic. But she has no problem making her way through the fog, right? She doesn't. She jogs straight there. She hops over a gate. She goes straight to the boathouse. She has no problem. She gets to the boathouse, and getting the boat and putting it in the water makes her feel almost normal. And she calls it a ritual. And I think that's an interesting choice of words, given that she's a witch. This time, going into the fog helps her feel. So here we have perhaps some witch symbolism, at least according to traditional Western folklore or traditional Western symbolism. When it's foggy, we hear from Diana, rowing feels like flying, she says. So according to tradition or according to folklore, what flies?
Flies and birds.
And witches.
Lots of things fly. I'm just going to put that out there.
That is true, but we're talking about Diana.
All right. You're wanting me to be specific. Okay. To the story. All right.
What do flies flying has nothing to do with the folklore.
It could.
So it's easy to lose orientation.
Depends on whose folklore we're talking about.
It's easy to lose orientation. There is no, and these are my words, there is no dark star to rely on. Or at least there's no way to see it. Here, she glides down the river on instinct alone.
But she's not the only jerkwad out on the river who's crazy.
Not, that's true. There are others. So rowing in the fog, her senses are sharpened. I don't doubt that an experienced rower could also make these claims, but how much of this is her being an experienced rower and how much a natural witch? Quote, ears and eyes tuned to the slightest change in the sound of my oars that would tell me I was getting too close to the banks or a shadow that would indicate the approach of another boat.
Well, I imagine it's a lot like when you lose one of your senses, the other ones become heightened. So in that regard, I could see that by basically blinding herself, the rest of her senses are more sharpened.
Absolutely. I'm just saying, I don't know, given it's Diana we're talking about, I don't know how much of it, like if I think the average experienced rower would absolutely have those senses heightened, like you just said, and like Diana's claiming, but we also know that she rode before with her eyes closed. And that's not, I mean, you could say that makes your senses heightened too, but she, girl's got some ability too. So it's just funny that Diana, over and over, we hear that Diana does things. And she says her senses are heightened because of this, or she does this because of that. Almost like she's trying to find reasons for herself to be able to do things. And so there is no way that she could be using magic. We see an instance of Diana not choosing the safe and the sensible. She almost turns back, but, quote, the prospect of a long, straight stretch of river was too enticing. So there's a point at which she was thinking about going back to the boathouse. When she does decide to return to the boathouse, we're reminded that it's her third night of bad sleep. Is there perhaps a significance to this number? I mean, I guess
everything comes in threes, right?
That, huh? Pretty much. Good
like,
things,
you
bad
know what else
things.
Comes in threes?
I don't know.
Guinea pigs.
Oh, good Lord. You know what else had happened this week? Happened this week with the guinea pigs?
What?
A virgin birth.
It was not a virgin birth.
That's true. It would have been, but it wasn't.
No, they were clearly getting it on in that cage
for 6 months or so. That's actually, it's kind of shocking. Okay, in case those of you who are listening have no clue what we're talking about, earlier this summer adopted two guinea pigs for her daughter, for the house, but for her daughter, and
from a breeder
who said
that they were both male,
and they were named Fergus and Henry. So everything was going swimmingly, as well as it can for guinea pigs. And Summer, do you want to say one thing? You did or did not notice a slight change in one of the guinea pigs?
There was a weird smell in the room for like the 5 days prior. Like it was not a normal smell. I clean the cage every morning. So when I went in to clean the cage the morning before the incident, I was trying to find the source of said smell. And I thought, well, maybe it's one of the guinea pigs, maybe because some guinea pigs are not super hygienic and they can require bathing. So I figured I would pick up one of the guinea pigs and see if they smelled bad. So I picked up Henry and I sniffed it and it didn't smell bad. So I was like, well, it's not the smell. And then as I was setting Henry back down into the cage, I looked at him. What I thought was a him.
Now she can't take it back.
And I said, God, you're getting fat. And I thought to myself, maybe I've been giving them too many carrots, because I'd been reading online, because they have to have fresh vegetables every day. And I was reading, you know, to limit the amount of carrots or sweet sugar containing vegetables that you give them, because guinea pigs can get heavy if you give them too much sugar. Like most animals and or humans, if you eat too much sugar, you can get fat. So I feel like I'm a terrible guinea pig owner. I've been overfeeding them sugar and carrots. So I was like, I set my little fat Henry down and I said, no more carrots for you.
Oh my God. It's cutting my little fat Henry. Sounds like a euphemism for something else.
No, it's not.
I don't know.
But I said, so basically I fat shamed my guinea pig.
And she learned a good lesson.
I'll get to that. So I set him down and I walked out, vowing to not give them as many carrots. Maybe carrots. I'm like, carrots once a week. Just once a week carrots. Just in all the green roughage they can have, but no carrots. So the next morning I went in to clean the cage like I always do. And I saw what appeared to be a rat. Something the size of a small rat in the cage running up the ramp to the upper tier of the cage. And I stopped my tracks. And I was like, what is that? And I walked over and I grabbed it. And I looked at it, and there was a baby guinea pig in the cage. And as I looked closer, there were, in fact, three baby guinea pigs in the cage and a significantly smaller Henry, who we have now had to rename Henrietta.
So basically, don't ever trust your guinea pigs. 6 months without babies does not mean you have two males.
No, it's
all it takes is 6 months and 1 day. And it will literally happen overnight.
Good Lord. And somebody asked me, they said, couldn't you tell the difference? Don't little male guinea pigs have different parts? And I said, well, look, I got them from a reputable breeder who's I considered the expert in the field. And then I brought them home and I respected their privacy. So I took the breeders at their word, and then I was not getting all up in their junk after I brought them home. So,
So basically the lesson learned is that you have to get all up in their junk when you have brand new ones. Otherwise, you may have the results of the junk rubbing.
Well, overnight, I went from two guinea pigs to five.
So,
but they're adorable.
So speaking of, you're right. So that, and the way, again, the tangent here was the number three.
Yep.
So maybe that's like a, is that like a good title? Something about threes? I mean, we don't have a lot of three stuff the rest of the episode, but it's up until now, it sounds good. So Diana is walking toward town, eyes closed, imagining another time or place. Who knows how long or far she walked, but as Summer said, quite a bit through town. But when she does open her eyes, of course, it's Matthew Claremont in front of her. And he startles the bejeezy out of her. He apologizes. He says he thought she had seen him. He asks why she walks with her eyes closed. She insists it's not magical, but that it's a game she's played since childhood.
She's silly. That is a magical game.
As is rowing with your eyes shut.
Exactly. Everything she does with her eyes shut.
So basically, she's in denial again. Oh, or yeah. So still. Still, she girlfriend. Okay. Kelly G writes, Diana seems to manage all right, though a sense of unease continues. Deb is pulling at a strange kind of tension, it seems. There is a woman who suffers from unaccountable nightmares alone in an ancient city with a vampire on the loose. To cap it all off, there is an unsettling layer of fog as well. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. In my mind, this seems a bit Dracula-ish. Diana, of course, chooses this time to walk back to her apartment with her eyes closed. Makes about as much sense as rowing along a river with your eyes closed. Of course, the creature appears at this point. Matthew emerges from the fog and damp toward Diana, whose eyes are still closed. When she opens them, she is once again plunged into fear. Once she manages to recover a bit, she vehemently denies that walking about with one's eyes closed has anything to do with magic. Diana should really teach lessons on denial. The scope of it is breathtaking. Matthew wisely decides not to mess with her today, perhaps acutely aware of her lack of sleep. So seeing how Matthew is so well-dressed, she feels a little self-conscious of her outfit, and we learn that she has a hole behind the left thigh of her rowing tights. First of all, I didn't know they're called rowing tights, so that's good to know. That she's not wearing yoga pants because she does both, so she probably has her own little
uniform.
Uniform is long, is better than I was trying to say, but it's a correct
gear.
Outfits, gear, yeah.
Tack.
Yeah. For every like little thing she has. She's got her outfit for the day, she's got her yoga stuff, she's got her rowing stuff, etc. Kelly G shares, it should be noticed at this point that once again, Diana observes the kind of pants Matthew wears. But I'm sure that is merely academic training.
No, wink. She's clearly wink. Trying to get into them.
Wink, wink. Matthew pushes her about the safety, sanity of her rowing on the river in the fog. And she admits he has a good point, but says she wants to enjoy the river before the students return. Matthew doesn't see students much as he's more of a researcher, and he's out of touch, it seems, with college life. He didn't even know that the term started the following week. Kelly G. shares, Diana and Matthew converse about the start of term, and we start to see how serious Matthew is. He doesn't take well to teasing and can be a bit prickly. Diana is not one to be easily frightened or cowed, however, and Matthew doesn't seem to mind as he offers her a ride back home. Now we see how far they have come in what I believe is a few short days. Sarah would be having a heart attack if she knew that Diana was riding in a car with a vampire. Yet it seems Matthew and Diana have both put aside prejudice and are drawn to one another's company. Matthew is pleased to give Diana a ride, and it doesn't seem he is pleased in a wolfish, predatory kind of way, but in a shy, almost human kind of way. It is rather cute, actually. Matthew offers her a ride, as Kelly says, and she accepts, planning to ask about his interest in 17th century alchemical manuscripts. As they walk to his car, they make small talk. Diana begins to wonder how many colleges he'd been a member of and says he seems as old as Oxford itself.
Now, is that a British thing to be a member of a college?
I don't think you'd... I mean, I wouldn't say it's a British thing. I would say it's a thing... that is British because that's the way British universities are, or English universities are.
I mean, is that your way of saying you went to that college?
I see what you're saying. You're asking what that means, basically.
Right. Does it mean you taught there? Does it mean you went to school there? Does it mean...
Okay, this is what I do know. So this might give you a tiny bit of information. When I was at St. Andrews, that's the university, right? Mm. The college I believe I was a member of, even though I studied history... was, I believe, St. Leonard's. And the reason I was part of that college was because it was, I believe, for students who were basically graduate students. So I'm not sure if being an undergrad, depending on your major or study area, what would put you in different colleges. I don't know. But I know that being a graduate student made us a member automatically of a college. So it somehow is related to what you study. But it also may be related to, because some are more prestigious than others. So it could have to do with your standing. Who knows? That's as far as I know. And so if any of our listeners are experts in this, or you know what, to be an expert, you have to know like one thing more than us and you're our expert. So if you could share, we'd love to hear more about that system of the colleges and how one becomes a member, or what that membership means and how they're kind of broken down. She starts to walk in the wrong direction and he corrects her. Again, I wrote, like a star guiding her home. Kelly G. writes, Matthew is parked in front of Christ Church College in a no parking zone, of course. Diana asks if he's a member of Christ Church, but Matthew says he has never been a member there. I was looking into Christ Church College and have a feeling I know why Matthew was not a member there. Established in 1546 by Thomas Wolsey, Christ Church College is one of the wealthiest and most aristocratic of the Oxford colleges and has produced many leaders and thinkers. Its alumni are well known, and the college itself is the setting for many movies such as the Harry Potter series. It is Oxford on a grand scale, probably one of the most notable and recognizable parts of the university, and we all know how Matthew hates publicity of any kind. He would have no interest in being associated with a college where his face and scholarship would be on display.
So like the whole Nobel Prize all over again.
Kelly G. continues, we do know that Matthew belongs to the highly secretive All Souls College, which was originally founded for scholars who had taken holy orders, but were not monks. It was founded by Henry V, who was highly religious and established the college as a chantry for his soul upon death. This is the source of the name of the college. Today, the college is graduate research focused, and the college has no undergraduates. Instead, postgraduates at Oxford may apply to All Souls through examination fellowships, which are often described as the hardest exams in the world. It is easy to see why Matthew would be drawn to such a college. Difficult entry, secretive rituals, a monk-like retreat from the world, and a focus on research.
You said monk-like retreat, and I'm thinking like a team building retreat, like where your work all goes to like some cabin in the mountains and like has like a work retreat.
Like a ropes monk course.
You're right. Like a monk retreat.
Monks on the ropes. No. And Kelly G continues, we also know that Diana is a member of New College, which paradoxically is rather old. It was established in 1379 and called New College to distinguish it from the older College of St. Mary. It was the first Oxford college for undergraduates and was originally designed to educate priests. So we see some parallels here. Diana is an educator who works with undergraduates and is a scholar and a teacher. Her college reflects that. Matthew is a researcher and a thinker who withdraws from the world rather like a monk, and his college reflects this. The motto of New College is rather famous, manners maketh man. At first glance, it seems rather straightforward and maybe simplistic. It is good to have good manners. But according to the New College webpage, the motto actually has a quite deeper meaning. It would be common at the time the college was founded to believe that class, family, and wealth made a person what they were. But the founder of New College believed it was how a person behaved that made a person. That made a person what they were. It didn't matter what you were born as, but how you acted toward your fellow humans that determined if you were a good person or not. Interestingly enough as well, New College is one of the few Oxford colleges to have won an Olympic medal in rowing. Oh, sorry. I just had a brain snap. Yeah. Did you see me move there?
It was visceral.
Or, yeah, something. So Matthew, of course, we learn, of course he has a black Jaguar. Of course he does. He parks where he wants.
Of course he does.
Look, girl. He did like the head bop and everything.
I was committed.
His car looks new as far as shiny and stuff, but the model seems to be older, so it doesn't have the latest technology of newer cars.
He clearly takes care of his nice things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, even if he didn't, which I'm sure he does, he could also have one specially made for him that, like, didn't have all the bells and whistles of new stuff, because he's like, I don't need that.
You can't go back in time and say, hey, no, could you make me a 1960s Jaguar?
No, you ask you have all the money you need to ask Jaguar to make him a one-of-a-kind thing, and they would. I mean, maybe they wouldn't, but if it's money.
A thing.
Yes. So he opens the door for her, and of course, it's luxurious.
Jaguar. What a silly, silly,
I know,
of course,
I know,
statement.
So Matthew invites her to breakfast. She observes that it's the second meal he'd invited her to, or not share with him. And she wonders if this is a vampire thing. Do they like to watch others eat?
I do.
Okay.
Like we have at work every month, and not every month.
Every month they have a Summer gets to watch you eat.
It's close to that. But every time we have a birthday, they bring a cake. And I always go in and I sing the birthday song with everybody. And then I'll sit and I don't eat the cake. But I will sit and watch everyone eat the cake, and I'll make them describe it to me and tell me all about the cake, because I don't eat cake, but I want to know about it. But I do enjoy watching people eat like treats and sweets and things like that I don't eat, because I want to hear about it and look at it and maybe smell it, but I don't want to eat it.
So this led to thoughts of vampire dietary habits, and she zips up the neck of her fleece pullover. She says, yes, let's go to breakfast. She's observing him as he drives. He rarely blinks, breathes, or moves. He seems to conserve energy. And this is another kind of scientific statement, right? The conservation of energy. And she becomes aware of how much she did move. Again, she wonders how old he is. Ellen G. writes, so she noticed as they were driving that Matthew had this stillness about him, and Diana could never stop moving. They arrive at the cafe, and Matthew opens the door for her again. He doesn't understand why today's women think it's important to open their own doors, and she says she thinks it's a sign of their independence. She remembers Chris's words on Claremont's behavior toward a woman at a conference. She gives in, accepting, no longer fighting, that he wants to open doors for her. So we can already see kind of a beginning of their negotiating. Of whatever relationship they have, it's being negotiated. LNG writes, opening the door for Diana, Matthew learns of her need of independence. I don't think this was a feminist reaction. I think it was a deeply rooted, unknown emotional trigger Diana has. I think that's a good observation. She said it was about women and independence, or her saying it was about women's independence could, on the surface, be read as kind of a feminist statement, correct? But I think Ellen has a good point. I think it's something that she feels viscerally, that she's responsible for herself. She can take care of herself, and she wants no connections, right? She's independent. And that's part of her not using magic, being her own person, doing things on her terms to keep things out of her life. And she has to be independent and cut off in a way from others to be that, to maintain herself. The woman behind the counter at the cafe, Mary, knew Matthew, so he was at least a semi-regular there. Matthew asks about Dan, and Mary takes Matthew and Diana to a table out of the way so they won't be bothered. Diana is placed with her back to the wall. He sits opposite her, between her and the rest of the room. A protective placement, I think. He's uncomfortable around others, she observes, more comfortable when it's just the two of them alone. She recognizes this from her studies of the Norwegian wolf. He is protecting her. She asks him who poses a threat, and he says that a man had said she looked tasty, and she says it was a compliment, likely in that modern English, or at the English of the day, and he says that it's difficult for him not to hear others' conversations. So when she's saying, basically, if you don't listen, you know, you won't have to be hearing all of these things. And he's like, it's very difficult because of my super, super hearing. So what appeared to be Mary's daughter came out to take their order. Matthew tells her Diana is from the state. And when the woman learns she's not from California, she's a little disappointed. We learn Diana orders eggs, toast, and bacon, while Matthew orders tea.
Lots of toast. Four slices of toast. That's like two sandwiches.
So in case you don't remember, Diana likes toast.
She likes the carbs.
She digs it. She does. Kelly G. writes, the ghostly mists recede, and we see the fairly ordinary scene of a bustling cafe during the breakfast rush. What we also see is how badly Matthew fits in here. His skin looks more pale, he doesn't eat, he is on edge, and he is no longer in command of himself.
But he orders tea. A lot of people go places that serve food and just have a drink. I've done that before.
But he's definitely not in a comfortable element.
No, he's not. But I did think it was interesting, and I understand the why he did it, But like when you see, or not see, or sometimes you see it like in movies or you read it in books, usually the dude in a situation goes to a restaurant or whatever and always sits with his back to like the wall. Like he doesn't want anyone to be able to like sneak up on him. Whereas he purposefully took the spot that would have, that was more of a protective stance. He put Diana against the wall and then put himself between her and everyone else in the room. So my brain thought he was going to automatically sit in the position where he put Diana. So I thought that was an interesting choice to, you know, move.
Diana notes that Matthew smells sweeter this morning, like a freshly picked carnation, and she inhales deeply. So she's willingly taking Matthew in on some level. Matthew says that people there know he's a little different, but that Mary is convinced he saved Dan's life, so she doesn't care. Matthew had intervened when Mary's husband had had a stroke and gone to the hospital when she was basically trying to tell the doctor, my husband had a reaction to this medication you gave him. The doctor basically either ignored it or brushed it aside. Matthew overheard this and came in and intervened for her. So she credits Matthew with saving her husband's life. Diana, meanwhile, is becoming dizzy with Matthew's spiciness. I thought I had to read that over a few times. Like, his what? She takes the lid off the teapot and inhales the tea to clear her head of the smell of carnations. What an interesting description. So his smell is changing. It's becoming sweeter to her. And now it's becoming overwhelming for her. And she didn't say it was making her sick. She was becoming dizzy. So she wanted to keep her mind straight. Kelly G writes, the scene in the cafe also serves to show that Matthew is not merely a frightening vampire. He is responsible for saving the life of the proprietress's husband. In his duties serving with John Radcliffe Hospital, Matthew had occasion to intervene before a medication reaction cost the husband his life. We see here that a vampire can save a human life, not just feast on their blood. It is worth noting that this revelation happens in the cafe once the fog has receded. We are all seeing Matthew in a more complicated light, as is Diana. Yet Matthew is still a vampire. His scent today acts even more strongly upon Diana. It seems that he is less spicy to her nose in the cafe, more sweet. Instead of the clove scent burning the back of her throat as it did in earlier chapters, she is drawn in by his scent and inhales deeply. I am a perfume collector and oftentimes assign certain scents to characters. Deb makes this super easy with her descriptors. I have always associated Matthew with Jo Malone's Pomegranate Noir, which is heavy on clove and dark fruit under laced. Oh, sorry. Which is heavy on clove and dark fruit, underlaced with spiciness akin to cinnamon and a hint of church incense. We know from chapter 3 that Matthew finds Diana's scent intriguing as well, although all we know so far is that Diana doesn't smell like a typical witch. Now we also learn how Diana likes her tea. Half a teaspoon of sugar, half a cup of milk. And then she stirs it, clockwise. This is definitely a magical reference.
Oh my, is that the magic making direction to turn, to spin your, stir your tea?
From what I understand.
Don't spin your tea, that sounds dangerous.
From what I understand, stirring something or moving it or walking, whatever, right? In the clockwise direction is to bring something to you, to affect something to happen. Whereas widdershins, backwards, anti or counterclockwise, or anti-clockwise, I believe, is the opposite, to banish or get rid of something. In magically speaking, like if you're doing a spell or something like that. So, who knows what she was thinking of?
It's one of the religions that they walk around, one walks around the other so many times when they're married, and if they get divorced, they walk the opposite way.
Maybe.
I feel like I've read that somewhere.
That would be interesting. Have you read Anne Bishop's Black Jewels trilogy? Oh my gosh, you would love it. Matthew is charmed by her seriousness regarding her tea. She asks him what his drink of choice is. Then he gets scathing. Exactly. Then he gets scathing with her. Quote, even humans know the answer to that question. End quote. She knew that she'd put her foot in her mouth as soon as she'd said it. Steph brought out her food with an additional helping of mushrooms and tomatoes. Her mom, Mary, had said she'd looked like death, meaning Diana. So Diana, while not near death, is less and less herself. And now someone saying, literally, she looks like death. What a transition she's made in the past 3 days.
Hey, it got her free vegetables.
And a ride in a Jaguar.
There you go.
This entire time, Matthew is watching her as she eats. So basically, Matthew is being Summer.
That's right.
Then she starts her inquiry. Why science? And then shoves toast in her mouth so she wouldn't talk. So she wouldn't have to talk. And he'd have to answer. He retorts, why history? And I wrote, touche. Ellen G. writes, I really liked the discussion. It's like a first date for them both. Questioning each other, but this is a different level as they are not humans, so they have their otherness to contend with also. She let him know that she read his journal entries and his response was sharp. I guess I should come back with that because it comes later. I'll come back to it. As he talks, he's building a moated castle out of the sugar jar and sweetener packets. Isn't this interesting? Diana was the one who had built a protective wall around herself in the reading room.
And now he's building one about himself.
Something like that. Kelly G. writes, he plays with his menu, builds moats and barriers out of his tabletop condiments, and is generally uneasy. He is also rather ridiculously old-fashioned, insisting on opening doors for Diana and acting as her protector even when she is not asked for such help. He is offended upon her behalf when others comment on her appearance. He does not fit in here in the modern world full of humans. The creature in the daylight is different than the creature in the foggy gloom. He says, I suppose I need to know why I'm here, to the answer of why science. And Diana is reminded of Agatha's similar words from the day before. We learn Diana thinks scientists are only interested in how things work and not why. And Matthew learns that she's been reading up on him. She asks about the connection between DNA research, animal behavior, evolution, and neuroscience. He says there is none. She calls him a liar and he is suddenly furious. She's reminded that she is eating with a lethal weapon. She says that there has to be something holding those things together. There must be, because she doesn't think he would go into different areas if they weren't. And he says that she is observant for a witch. She says, vampires aren't the only creatures who hunt. And he replies, no, we all hunt something, don't we, Diana?
Books. They all hunt books.
Lingering. That's true. But he lingers over her name. So you get that play on words, right? Diana, the goddess, the huntress. She tells him that she chose history because it seemed so neatly packaged, done, and predictable. The stories were intriguing, but then it became more challenging when it became less neat, she says. It's her job to discover and explain the secrets and obsessions of the people of the past. He asks, what if you can't? She replies, that's never happened. And then, at least I don't think it has. All you have to do is to be a good listener. Nobody really wants to keep secrets, not even the dead. People leave clues everywhere, and if you pay attention, you can piece them together. End quote. As someone who is not a professional historian, myself, Ginger, I would guess that this is partially true. But if she says it's never happened, to her at least, how much of this is her magic?
I mean, that's the ongoing question, though, of her, how much of her entire career is unintentional magic. It's the age-old question.
Since episode 2, Matthew asks her why the history of science, and she says, the challenge of great minds, I suppose. Then Matthew slowly begins to take down his moated castle. Now I ask you, is this representative of at least the outermost barrier of his dropping away?
What did he do? What did you say?
Are you part of this conversation? I don't even know what's happening anymore. He slowly begins to take down his moated castle made of the sugar stuff.
I think so. It's totally representative. It's the physical manifestation of the conversation they're having. So I think that it totally is exactly that.
And then we have one of our first mentions of the magic of knots. Quote, the knotted threads of my own secrets began to loosen. I wanted to know how humans came up with the view of the world that had so little magic in it. I needed to understand how they convinced themselves that magic wasn't important. The answer, we find from Diana, is that magic never really went away. It waited, quietly, for people to return to it when they found the science wanting. This is a really beautiful line, reflective perhaps of Diana, what she's doing. Ellen G. writes, I really like this discussion. It's like a first date for them both, questioning each other, but this is a different level, as they are not humans, so they have their otherness to contend with. She let him know that she had read his journal entries, and his response was sharp. Was it the questions she was asking? Was it that he felt he needed to protect her? Was he uncomfortable in the diner himself? And did he let that dis-ease come into the discussion? Ellen G. continues, and as Matthew began to take apart his castle, Diana's, quote, knotted threads of my own secrets began to loosen.
Hmm.
And she ends that quote with, I won't say anything more.
No, that'll come back.
Oh, heck yeah. Matthew asks if alchemy is when people return to magic, and she is absolutely adamant that no, alchemy is not magic. It is one of the earliest forms of experimental science.
No, she's been playing that same song for a while now.
Yep. At most, she says. So she does give a tiny bit here. At most, she says it's science with magic, or magic with science. So at first she's 100% adamant that it is not involved, and then she kind of flips and says, well, it's a tiny bit. Kelly G. writes, Matthew isn't the only one to be seen in a different light. We know that typically Matthew has very little to do with witches and probably does hold some prejudiced views about them. Diana is challenging his assumptions here about witches at the very least, and perhaps about women in general. He is surprised at how much information she has acquired about his research interests and her attempts to connect the dots between his varied pursuits. He shows grudging respect as well as a quick temper to Diana's queries. Diana opens up a bit to Matthew regarding her interest in the history of science, and we get a hint that Diana may owe her scholarship in some degree to magic. She has an uncanny knack for uncovering the secrets of the past. Is that good detective work? Or is she using her magic in some capacity without being fully aware? She also digs in even further in her refusal to acknowledge alchemy as containing magic, showing her magical denial abilities to great effect. At least here, Matthew is able to get her to concede a bit on the alchemy front, something Sarah was unable to do. She asks him why he's interested in her work on alchemy. The alchemist wanted to know why they were here, too. Then the spell ends. He offers to take her to the library, but she has to shower, and she says she has to go to do yoga that night. And Matthew jumps on this. He also does some yoga, we find out. He asks about her yoga practice, where she studies, and with whom. Again, really, he's jump in there. And then he offers to take her to yoga with him the next night. He says the class is hard to describe.
But and clearly it's better than whatever she's doing.
Like, you do what you're going to do. Tomorrow I'm going to blow your mind with yoga. He drops her off at the lodge, and she puts $10 into an envelope and addresses it to Chris. Her friend had won his bet. Ellen G. writes, Diana has lived in fear her whole life, and the way she lives her life now is a response to that. She must be in control. Doing magic is not her being under control. Her aunt and M. Get it? Auntie M? Her aunt, I know! Her aunt and M don't know all of what happened to Diana, as she wasn't being raised by her parents. They don't know anything of that, but they have stoked the fire of her fear instead of trying to find out what her fear is. M knows more than Sarah, and that is why she is more patient with Diana. Kelly G. writes, these two seem unable or unwilling to keep apart. After finishing breakfast, Matthew drives Diana back to New College, but not before he has a second date, so to speak, a yoga class. Smooth move, Matthew. It is clear that Matthew has something up his sleeve, but that is for another chapter. Here it is enough to see that the two of them are even more entwined than they were before. They have shared a meal, in a certain sense, and shared information about themselves. They are no longer witch and vampire, prey and predator, woman and monster. They are both becoming more and more unmasked. The chapter begins with the familiar trope of horror and ends instead with both creatures being more understood. It is a rather fun way to flip the genre.
Yes, and I think they are on more equal footing now that she's done her internet stalking of him. So they've each stalked each other probably in equal amounts at this point.
Maybe equal amounts of information, but not equal amounts of time. I'm sure he looked her up. I'm sure he read about her more than a day or two. She's only had a few days to do this research online. But well, as far as information, it was deep.
His wasn't that much longer. I mean, his was only a couple of days before hers, as far as I know. Because she wasn't even on his radar until she pulled the book.
That's true. So they had it almost the same time. Wow. So basically this chapter starts in fog. Diana in the beginning and throughout the end, mostly at the end, is still denying magic in every way possible.
Clearly she's still in the fog.
That's true. She's still in the... I don't want to say has a foggy mind. That's not what I mean to say. But symbolically, yes, she is. Well, it's funny you say that because even in the fog, I still think her closing her eyes had... She, again, her senses very well were like very likely heightened in some capacity. But again, we're talking about Diana. I don't think you can fairly say that she is ever without it, even that whole thing she does with seeing the puzzle pieces come together on that whiteboard. What is that? She thinks it's like, oh, it's the way I put things together. Well, yeah. It's a touch of magic, girlfriend. Because if it always works for her, come on now.
Girlfriend.
Sorry. Diana, you're my girlfriend. No.
You're dating?
Look, she's got a hot vamp. No, we're not dating. So that was
That's the only reason you're not dating? She has a hot
and she's
vamp?
She's fictional.
She's not real.
I guess there's that. And I like dudes, so. So that was an interesting... It was kind of a nice chapter, right? I mean, it had a lot of symbolism and it had... It was fun to read, but this is the first time they've, even though they're not alone, this is like the longest conversation they've had, no?
I mean,
where they haven't been like really fighting.
Well, it's an actual conversation.
That's true.
So, I mean,
maybe it's the toast.
You know, feed the beast and the beast is.
I thought you were going to say feed the bitch. No. Feed the beast.
Feed the beast and the beast calms.
Oh, my goodness.
Hungry people are not the best conversationalists.
That's true.
So clearly she was in a much better mood once he fed her.
And the veggies seemed to brighten her mind, brighten her her spirit. But she did like that toast. You're right.
You know, it's so funny that they call those the veggies. It's a fungus and a fruit.
That's true.
And they were like,
wait, did I just call it veggie or is it in the book too?
I think in the book she's like, you needed, you know, something other than toast and eggs and protein. They needed some vegetables or some sort of a...
Well, okay. If you look at the whole animal, vegetable, mineral, it would be under vegetable because it's not a rock and it's not a cat.
No, I mean, technically it's a vegetation. It's, you know, it grows, but it's still... I wouldn't consider... If I was looking for like nutritional content, those would not be like my go-to veggies.
I hear you.
First of all, I don't really like tomatoes and I don't really like mushrooms.
And you don't really like greens, so there's not much left.
I like greens. You hush a dun.
You hush a what?
Hush a dun. I don't know.
I've never heard that ever.
Me either. Just happened right there. Welcome. So that was chapter 7 of A Discovery of Witches.
Apparently,
join us back in our next episode when we discuss chapter 8.
So basically, I will translate that. Sorry, I will interpret that.
Don't hurt yourself. Longest pause ever.
So thank you so much for joining us. We had a great time. I love this chapter. I don't know why. It was just so much fun. And I can't wait till chapter 8.
All right, y'all. Get your yoga mats ready.
Oh, my gosh. We should all dress in our yoga outfit.
I mean, I'm basically wearing yoga pants now.
So, yeah. I will have... Well, we have to sit in chairs, so I can't sit in my yoga mat. But I can put out my yoga mat. We can put on some yoga music. Well, no, because we don't have copyright. But we'll figure something out. But yeah, we get our yoga on next week. Have you ever done yoga?
Yeah. Didn't we take a yoga course at AR together.
Oh, that's
that one
right.
Time.
Sorry. Yes. I thought you were going to say, didn't we do yoga at All Souls Con? I was like, no.
And
we did a few sweet little moves, but that was, I guess.
Sweet little moves. Did you check out my sweet moves? My sweet yoga moves?
No. Margo had the sweet moves, but she did. Showing us stuff.
I'm just glad she didn't have us do downward dog.
Oh, Lord have mercy. I'm glad she didn't have us do downward anything. Anything. Even Shavasana. I love Shavasana.
Well, we just had breakfast. That would have been bad.
That's true. But yeah, I can't wait till we get the talk about yoga. In whatever capacity. And so we'll see how it goes. I'll close again. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to our next yoga chapter.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. You can find our audio channel at www.audioboom.com/channel/AllSoulsPod. Many thanks to Penguin Audio and Recorded Books for allowing us to use portions of the audiobooks in our show. Visit our website at www.allsoulspod.com. Follow us on Twitter at AllSoulsPod. Find us on Facebook by searching for The All Souls Podcast or email us at allsoulspod@gmail.com.